It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later, it's flu season, and we look at the pros and cons of vaccination with a toxicologist who's studying its effects over time.
First, the nation is still reacting to a grand jury's decision not to indict the Ferguson police officer who shot and killed 18-year-old Michael Brown. The announcement came down last night, spawning protests in Ferguson and across the nation.
President Obama appealed for peace in the aftermath of the ruling, but it was an emotional night, and parts of Ferguson saw reports of gunshots, looting, and arson fueled by racial unrest and a sense that justice had not been served. Now that it's the day after, all eyes are still on the St. Louis suburb. And what happens next?
Here with us now to discuss the situation in Ferguson is Willis Arnold. He's a reporter at St. Louis Public Radio. He was on the ground in Ferguson last night. Willis, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Certainly.
Well, before we look back at last night, what are you hearing about what's going on in Ferguson now, today?
Most of today in Ferguson itself is actually focused on cleanup and kind of gently assessing the damage. People are out looking at their businesses. We have reporters in the field who are talking to people about exactly how much damage was done and what the kind of toll is of last night.
And how widespread is that toll? How big an area of Ferguson was directly affected?
The primary areas of Ferguson that were affected were two specific streets. There's South Florissant Road, which is an area that's directly in front of the Ferguson Police Department, and then there is the West Florissant Street, which is where a lot of the protests that you would have seen in August took place. And a lot of the businesses along both of those streets were affected, but not a lot of the kind of arson or images that you would have seen on the nightly news last night spread to other surrounding areas in St. Louis.
Well, take us back to last night. You were in Ferguson reporting. We're hearing all kinds of reports today about what happened. What kinds of things did you see?
I saw a range of things. The night began peacefully. People waited outside the Ferguson Police Department. A couple hundred people gathered and listened to the verdict come in through the radio, through car radios. And initially the response was to run to the police barricade in front of the police station. Protesters expressed their dissatisfaction and then kind of came into a lull, focused on chanting and kind of called for peace. And then they started to march towards a police line, which had formed at the few blocks down south of on South Florissant from the police station. The police formed a line, and from there things began to escalate.
Now, in what I've seen from your reporting there at St. Louis Public Radio, a lot of protesters were actively discouraging arson, looting, violence, that sort of thing. What kind of things are you hearing from the protesters who were hoping things would stay peaceful?
Most of the protesters really were focused on that peaceful protest and were focused on marching and chants and expressing their dissatisfaction in a nonviolent way. I spoke with one woman who immediately after the non-indictment came down expressed that they were there, that they were angry, that people were frustrated, but they really hoped there would be peace. Later, I spoke to a young man who had stopped someone. He got in front of a person who was trying to set a bar on fire and told them that that was not the way to handle the situation, and that person was discouraged. It seems like most of the arsons and looting and things that happened were scattered. It wasn't like a large roving group of people that was causing mass destruction. It kind of like popped up here and there.
Well, turning to the police response, what did you see as far as their preparation, and was most of the violence where the police weren't?
I was specifically located at the Ferguson Police Department for most of the time that I was in the area, which was, I would say, heavily, there was a strong police presence, and the initial actions that I witnessed turn kind of violent occurred after the police were in riot gear and blocked off a street where people were marching. And then it kind of became, not to use a cliche, but a bit of a cat and mouse game where people, it would be hard, I imagine, for the police to keep track of smaller bands of people that would be walking throughout the neighborhood. And it didn't seem like a lot of the confrontation was directly aimed at police, but kind of spread out in general frustration.
Now, looking toward tonight and looking ahead, we're hearing reports of how and whether the state's National Guard will be deployed. What kind of things are you hearing? What are people wanting to see when it comes to the National Guard?
My impression is that it sort of depends on where the person is and what they're talking and who they're talking to. Business owners certainly want their property protected, and there has been some talk of the National Guard being deployed for that reason this evening in anticipation of continued violence. But a lot of the protesters that I spoke with were really trying to focus on the idea of nonviolent protest. There was a march today that was primarily nonviolent and took place in downtown St. Louis. And right now we are, Governor Jay Nixon is currently giving a press conference and may have some more information on that when he's finished.
And what did you hear last night from Ferguson residents, from protesters, about what they want to see moving forward? What kind of organizing, what kind of action are they looking ahead to?
I think in the immediate future we're going to see continued protests, continued marches, continued planned actions. We saw a wide variety of these in August. We saw everything from pop-up protests in areas throughout the city to planned marches to attempts to block roadways and things like that. I would not be surprised if we saw similar actions. A lot of the people in the long term started to focus on whether or not there would be the chance for the federal government to get involved and what further legal ramifications were going to be possible.
Now, looking in from the outside, we had a lot of attention nationally on Ferguson in the summer, of course, and the weeks that followed the initial shooting. We're paying attention again after this grand jury ruling and the reaction there. Has there been a protest in the area between then and now? What's been going on that maybe we weren't focusing on between those events?
There have been key presences of protesters in different areas. So there have been some hot spots. West Florissant has remained an active area, although it has dwindled up until last night. Outside the police department, there have been anywhere from a handful of people to a couple hundred people on various nights since the August kind of peak of activity. And then there have been other smaller actions. There was an event called Ferguson October where protesters invited people throughout the country to come and protest. And there was a march down a main street in downtown St. Louis. And I just wanted to let you know, you asked earlier what we could expect in terms of the National Guard. We are getting reports from Jason Rosenbaum, my colleague at this station, that the governor is saying the National Guard presence will be ramped up this evening and that they should be stationed throughout the city.
There was talk of, and throughout the protest, talk of possibility of coordination, communication mainly, I guess, between protest leaders and the police. Did we see much of that last night? Is there talk of trying to get that going in future protests?
I think that a lot of the initial protests, because it is decentralized, a lot of those initial talks took place between an older generation of protesters and not necessarily in communication with a younger group of protesters. I don't know that for certain, but that seems to be the way that this has happened, and I think that that might have been similar last night. There may have been conversations between some of the more established community leaders, but most of the younger, youthful protesters that I spoke with were not speaking with cops and were kind of declining to speak with media as much as possible because they were focused on the people that were out there and the people that they were friends with and knew and were around the area.
Willis, thanks for your coverage and for sharing your firsthand perspective with us today.
Certainly. Thank you for speaking with me.
That was Willis Arnold. He's a reporter at St. Louis Public Radio who was in Ferguson, Missouri last night.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Politico magazine has spent 2014 investigating innovative ideas that are helping urban areas reinvent themselves. In their latest installment, they look at how Milwaukee has used data and community policing to reduce crime.
First, every year around this time, we're bombarded with reminders to get the flu shot.
And every year around this time, we also hear people warning of possible dangers of immunization or saying it's unnecessary, that the human immune system can deal with the flu on its own.
How does the vaccination process alter viruses and affect health in the short and long term? With us now to look at that question is environmental toxicologist Emily Monison. She's adjunct professor at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst and the author of the new book, Unnatural Selection, How We're Changing Life Gene by Gene. Emily, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
For a lot of people, the decision whether or not to get the flu shot, for instance, or to vaccinate their kids, it's a tough one. What is the thinking behind some of the questions about not getting a flu shot?
Well, first I have to say that every year I have asthma, and so I get the flu vaccine, and I ask my family and friends also to get the flu vaccine. And because of this, it made me sort of wonder, because I live in an area where people have a lot of questions, as you say, about vaccinations. Should they get vaccinated against the flu? So since I was thinking about rapid evolution and how we change things like how the chemicals that we use and cause resistance in antibiotics and herbicides and pesticides cause resistance, I wondered what we might do to viruses. And so one of the questions is, the flu virus is evolves very rapidly, which makes it really interesting from an evolutionary perspective. It's sort of a master of evolution. And the virus evolves in response naturally to our immune system. So it's a sort of predator-prey relationship where we get infected by the flu virus, our immune system responds, and the viruses mutate. And some of those mutations might be helpful, and some of those mutations might not be helpful, and some of them might help them evade our immune response. And so the question that I had was, well, if our immune response influences evolution of flu viruses, I was wondering just if vaccination would do the same thing, because what vaccination does is provoke our immune response. And so that's the question that I explored in the book, and it turns out that it's very unlikely that vaccination would influence evolution of the immune response, in part because we just don't have high enough coverage, and in part because how flu viruses evolve.
Right. So that's an interesting question, I mean, that people have wondered about, besides yourself as well. You know, are we creating deadlier viruses by getting vaccinated? Because we get vaccinated, the virus falls behind, and then it races to catch up, and maybe it could overtake us. Are there any examples that you can point to that show that maybe that could be happening?
The one example that I refer to in the book, where there is that kind of dynamic with vaccination and a virus, is a bird virus called Marek's disease, which causes cancers in poultry. What happened was the virus infected poultry. There was a very high rate of vaccination in response, and it looks like the virus has evolved to be more virulent, a better killer, in response to vaccination. But that was a very high coverage, and it's a very different virus from flu. And I think that the people who study, like Andrew Reed, who study responses of viruses like the flu to vaccines, think that this is pretty unlikely, that even if we had very good coverage of vaccination for flu, which we don't, we tend to have, I mean, at best, maybe 30, 40, 50% in the country, so it's not a really high coverage like they had in that case, that even if we had that, the way flu evolves probably wouldn't drive it to be a more virulent kind of virus.
Well, you've said that our immune system is pretty incredible. It's like a 3D printer on steroids. And there are people in the natural health community and elsewhere who say that the body's own immune system can fight off the flu and viruses. So if that's the case, why should we get vaccinated?
That's a good question. We do have very good, we have a miraculous immune response. The problem is that everybody doesn't. And so when I get a flu vaccine, and if I don't get the flu, what I'm doing is protecting my neighbor who might be more susceptible. Maybe they're immunocompromised. Maybe they're elderly and they're not able to mount a really good immune response. Or maybe they're very young and they can't mount a good immune response. So So by getting vaccinated, people like me or my family are helping to prevent transmission of the virus.
Now, the seesaw effect between viruses and the immune system is really interesting to track. And you write about some Australian rabbits that really show this to good effect. Can you tell us a little bit about that story?
So that story is one that takes place. It's in Australia, as you mentioned. And what happened was Australia didn't have a natural population of rabbits. And so some hunters back before last century decided that they would bring some rabbits to Australia. They did, and of course, rabbits being rabbits, they multiplied like rabbits, and there were no natural diseases, no natural predators, and so they became a problem, which is why we hear about things like the rabbit-proof fence and a lot of different, they were basically eating Australians out of house and home and other animals too. And so the response to that, one way to combat them was basically a kind of biological warfare, was to bring in a disease that could kill off the rabbits, and so they brought in a virus called a myxoma virus that infected rabbits in another country, and they brought that to Australia, and since it was new to that population, it was devastating. And so that virus killed off like 99.99 whatever percent of the rabbits, but a few survived. And so those that survived were resistant to the virus, and they reproduced. And so what ended up happening was there was a seesawing kind of thing between population, and the virus got less virulent, because if it killed off those last few rabbits, there wouldn't be a virus. And so there was sort of a seesawing between the rabbit population and the how virulent or how good a killer the virus was.
And the story kind of gets at another point that you make, that maybe we need to let go of the idea of, for instance, a cure for cancer just because of the nature of the way viruses work. Can you tell us why that is?
Because the nature of the way viruses work. Well, the reason actually I mentioned cancer in chemotherapy is actually evolution of the cancer cells themselves. And so the thinking there, which was kind of interesting to explore, was how researchers working on chemotherapy agents are now thinking in cancer-treating drugs are thinking that they need to take a more evolutionary approach to cancer. Think of cancer as an evolutionary disease. Cancer cells evolve, and they evolve rapidly in response to the chemotherapy and drug agents that we use. And so some have proposed that maybe if we don't, that's so we impose a very strong selective pressure on cancer cells, just like the myxoma was a strong selection pressure on rabbits and immune system, and just like our immune system is a strong selection pressure on viruses, we're imposing a really strong selective pressure on cancer cells. And if we back off, and if we find a sort of cancer drug, if there are drugs that really work and are very targeted to cancer cells, there's some suggestion that maybe researchers explore sort of trying to keep a population of cancer cells that remain sensitive to the chemotherapy or targeted drugs around and in play.
How would you do that? How would you keep them sensitive?
Well, I think it's you don't blast them. I'm not a cancer drug developer researcher. I do know that one example of this in a totally different situation is in agriculture, where the genetically altered BT corn, so the corn carries a gene that makes it toxic to the insects that feed upon the corn. And one requirement for farmers who were using the BT corn was to have a refuge area. So they needed to plant corn that didn't have that gene, because that would allow the insects to feed upon that corn they wouldn't develop resistance, because they weren't feeding upon the BT corn. They were feeding upon non-BT corn. And so that sort of, they could dilute the population of insects that might get resistant by feeding on BT corn. And so that's sort of an analogy, is that if you can keep a population of insects or cells around that can sort of dilute that resistant population, then you might be able to keep the disease population or the pest population in check.
Now, there's a hopeful note that you write about. It's still theoretical. It's not widely in practice. But you talk about the possibility of a universal vaccine, which I guess could wipe out things like the flu and a whole bunch of other stuff, too. What is the universal vaccine that we're talking about?
Well, so the universal vaccine is sort of that's kind of a name for various different types of vaccines that are being developed against the flu. how flu tends to evolve is there's a specific region of the flu that's sort of very mutable. It's a protein that evolves pretty rapidly, and that evolves in response to our immune response. What universal vaccines try to do is target a part of that protein that evolves rapidly that doesn't evolve, that's highly conserved. And by doing that, it's a protein that tends to be similar among flu strains and different flu viruses. And so by targeting this highly conserved region that doesn't evolve in response to our immune system, it might make a vaccine that's more broadly active and a vaccine that might last longer than just the year or two that the vaccines tend to be effective for, because flu is constantly evolving.
Now, as we wrap up here, you've asked yourself, should I get my child the flu vaccine? She seems perfectly healthy. What's your takeaway about the safety of vaccines?
I get my children vaccinated. I think that vaccines, it's indisputable that flu vaccines save tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of lives a year in this country. And so it's very important that we do get vaccinated, and also not just to protect ourselves, as I mentioned earlier, but to protect other more vulnerable people in our population. And so my takeaway is to get vaccinated, and the exploring whether or not flu vaccine can sort of cause a more virulent strain of flu is really more of a hypothetical kind of thinking, and something that is likely not to happen.
Emily, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Emily Monison, environmental toxicologist and the author of Unnatural Selection: How We Are Changing Life Gene by Gene.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we take a look at how Milwaukee is using data and community policing to focus on preventing crime rather than responding to it.
First, the Walker administration's plan to raise fees and taxes to help fund transportation projects in the state continues to draw criticism. Chuck Kornbach reports some of the opposition is from owners and sellers of hybrid cars.
Cars and trucks zoom on Interstate 43 in downtown Milwaukee. The din goes on night and day. But at least some of the vehicles passing below are getting better gasoline mileage than vehicles did years ago. And so those drivers are paying less in the way of per-gallon gas taxes. Shaky tax revenue, uncertainty about federal highway dollars, and other factors have prompted the state DOT to release a two-year state budget plan that would increase taxes and fees $750 million. A proposed $50 annual fee on gas electric hybrids and electric vehicles is raising concerns for drivers of those alternative-fueled four-wheelers. Justin Fons cruises down a Milwaukee street in his 2014 Ford plug-in hybrid. The vehicle can run on stored electricity for up to 20 miles, then switches to gasoline. Fons says combined, he gets great gas mileage.
With a mix of my city driving, which is all electric, and highway driving, which is all gas, or mostly gas, I'm averaging 82.1 miles per gallon in this vehicle.
Fon says with his plug-in, he wouldn't mind paying an annual fee to the state to help fund road maintenance, but he opposes charging owners of non-plug-in hybrids the $50.
Because they are already paying that gasoline tax as a motor fuel. They don't get any additional power outside of that.
A prominent seller of hybrids is firmly against the state's proposal. Chris Schneider is president and advanced fuel vehicle guru at Honda Motorworks, a car dealership in La Crosse. Schneider says hybrids usually cost a few $1,000s more than conventional vehicles, and the state has already been tacking on 5% to that.
I think that hybrid owners have already paid additional state taxes when they spend the extra money that it requires to invest in higher technology. And so an additional fee would essentially be double taxation.
With Governor Scott Walker out of Wisconsin for most of the period since the DOT released its budget proposal, DOT Secretary Mark Gottlieb has been the main spokesperson for the document. He says the hybrid and electric fee would be fair.
Obviously, there are many benefits to driving a alternatively fueled vehicle, environmental benefits, cost benefits to the vehicle owner. Those are all still there. What we are trying to capture here with this fee is the differential fuel taxes that are not being paid by those vehicles.
But yesterday, more groups criticized the state's transportation funding plan. Manufacturers, grocers, petroleum marketers, and the State Restaurant Association all questioned whether the amount of the proposed revenue increases are appropriate. The groups also said the plan may put Wisconsin employers at a competitive disadvantage. Governor Walker has said significant changes are likely in the DOT's proposal. Secretary Gottlieb last week wouldn't say if, to begin with, he had run the package past the governor.
I'm not going to discuss what internal communications took place putting the budget together.
Governor Walker is expected to make his transportation proposal in a few months. Chuck Quernbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Chuck asked Toyota to comment on the proposed $50 annual fee on gas electric hybrids. It declined an interview and offered this statement. Toyota and the industry will continue to oppose efforts in states to add fees or taxes that unnecessarily favor one technology over another. Further studies indicate that advanced technologies such as hybrid and electric vehicles are not inflicting an equal amount of road damage as heavy-duty vehicles. We're planning to share alternative solutions with those studying these important issues in Wisconsin.
Now we take a look at why Milwaukee is getting national attention for its success in cutting crime.
Criminal justice and race relations are in the headlines today in the wake of a grand jury decision in Ferguson, Missouri, not to indict Officer Darren Wilson, who shot and killed 18-year-old Michael Brown this past August.
Milwaukee has had its fair share of distrust between the black community and the police force. Just this past April, a white Milwaukee police officer fired 14 rounds and killed Dontre Hamilton, a mentally ill, unarmed black man. Protests ensued, and the police chief dismissed the officer for not following protocol.
While the force may face challenges, it's also being recognized for growing relationships with the community and using a data-driven approach to help prevent crime rather than just respond to it. Today, Milwaukee has the lowest homicide rate of any big city with high poverty rates in the country, faring much better than cities like Detroit, Baltimore, Newark, and Cleveland.
Politico magazine recently featured Milwaukee's police force in its What Works series, which focuses on innovative ideas that are helping to reinvent urban areas. Eric Gunn, a Milwaukee-based journalist who wrote the piece How Milwaukee Went Soft on Crime, joins us now. Eric, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, let's start off with a premise that may surprise people around the state that might think of Milwaukee as a high crime area. Crime rates have been getting better over the last couple of decades?
They have, and they have continued to do so even in the face of the fact that Milwaukee certainly continues to struggle economically. And to the degree that the economics and economic disparities are a part of what contributes to higher crime, they're kind of going against the grain, if you will.
So what kind of things happen to go against the grain? What are people chalking these positive results up to?
Well, there are, I think, several different things at work here. But a big one is the role of the police officer in interacting with the community in which she or he are stationed. Closely related to that were some changes that Edward Flynn, chief since 2008, made upon becoming chief here, namely downsizing the number of plainclothes people who were attached to the detective bureau and putting some of those folks back in the local individual neighborhood stations so that they also become part of this effort to be closer to the community and spend some energy in crime prevention as well as detection of and solving of crimes.
Let's follow up on this community policing concept. How does that play out in what an officer, plainclothes or uniformed, might do out on the streets on a shift?
Well, a lot of it plays out in bigger events in terms of how the department as an institution interacts with the neighborhood. There are meetings in every district, every month, community meetings that really acquaint people much more with the department, with the department leaders in that district. But then when it comes down to the individual, there is a greater effort to know and understand the individuals in the community in a way that was not as emphasized in the past, in terms of who the players are, good and bad, in terms of listening to what they have to say, in terms of being responsive when people have a complaint about a problem in a particular area, whether, you know, it might be a rash of burglaries or even less apparently serious events such as vandalism. All of that is part of this, but it's probably not quite enough to explain it all. There's other aspects to what has been done, and it's not so much sort of one silver bullet as a fundamental rethinking of how police work is done and what actually constitutes police work.
And I want to get into that and some of the data-driven items you mentioned. But before we move on from the community relation building between police and communities, obviously a huge topic given what's going on in Ferguson, distrust between minority communities on one hand, police on the other. How is Milwaukee doing when we look at national comparisons and we look at Milwaukee's own past?
Well, certainly Milwaukee has some very difficult things in the past to overcome. You could go back to the 1950s when there was a notorious killing of an African American civilian and a concerted cover up that only came to light much later. And when I arrived in Milwaukee in the mid-80s, it was the subject of a play, interestingly enough. It's kind of a documentary play. So you've got that. You've got the something like 20-year tenure of Chief Harold Breyer, very tough law and order guy, and infamous for some racist comments that he made at various times in his tenure as chief. And then even since that time, there have been a series of incidents that have, again, pointed to the work that still needs to be done in terms of building better bridges between the department and the community, especially the African-American community. You had the severe beating of a biracial man in 2004 at a police by off-duty police at a party. You had the Frank Jude case. You had the death a few years ago of a man in custody who died basically following an asthma attack and who was not initially believed to be having a health problem when he was complaining that he couldn't breathe. And then you have the case of Dontre Hamilton that you mentioned back in April. So all of those things have certainly raised and continue to raise questions. The interesting thing is about all of that, quite bluntly, there has not been the degree of intense protest. I'm not saying there has not been protests, and I'm not saying that there have not been, sincere protests, but there's not been the kind of overwhelming scale of protest in Milwaukee that you saw, for instance, in Ferguson, Missouri. There are different interpretations of that. People who are much more skeptical of the police today say, well, maybe it's just that people in Milwaukee feel so beaten down. But I will tell you that Tom Barrett, the mayor, and Chief Flynn as well, said to me in various ways that maybe there isn't that quite that depth of mistrust because of some of the success in very subtle ways that the department has had in making inroads into its connections with the community.
We're speaking with Eric Gunn, Milwaukee-based reporter and contributor to Politico magazine, about Milwaukee's data-driven approach to fighting crime.
Politico magazine has pointed to Milwaukee's approach as a guide for other cities that are looking to prevent crime rather than just respond to it. And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think the Milwaukee Police Force is doing a good job of forging relationships with the community? Do you approve of Police Chief Edward Flynn's work in the city? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're back with Eric Gunn, Milwaukee-based reporter and contributor to Politico magazine, talking about Milwaukee's data-driven approach to fighting crime.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed a change in Milwaukee's policing tactics over the last two decades? Is it a change for the better? Do you think it's the police force's responsibility to do the kind of community building, relationship management we were talking about? Call 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Eric, we hit a lot of the community relationship building. A big part of your piece is on a kind of a data-driven approach to policing. What kind of forms has that taken?
Yeah, what that does is a much more intense awareness and particularly much closer to real-time awareness of what's happening and where it's happening. So that a pattern, for instance, of burglaries in a particular area will become much clearer, much faster. There's also data sharing across the different districts in a way that has not been possible in the past, thanks to computer technology and so on, but also because it was made a priority when Ed Flynn became chief. So that, for instance, if a person who might be, let's say, a bad actor has surfaced on people's radar screen in connection with one particular series of crimes in one district, and then that there's a similar method of crime, it's a burglary where everybody's, being broken into in quite the same way or at quite the same time of day or something like that, then that information spreads from one district to another much more quickly. There's also a weekly meeting. It's called CompStat, which was a term that originated in New York City. Basically, computerized statistics is what that relates to. And they look at individual districts and drill down to such things as, how many times are officers interacting with members of the community. Now, it is not so much emphasizing arrests and tickets written, although it sometimes gets portrayed that way by some who are skeptical of it, but more just direct contact with the community, which is another way that you get that sense of who is in your neighborhood and that we talked about before. So those are some of the ways that they're using data, and it seems to be helpful in letting them make decisions about where to deploy people. For instance, if there's a rash of burglaries, there can be some discipline look at where do you think they might be going next, to stake out potential upcoming targets. That seems to be working and helping to be part of that big reduction in crime that you mentioned at the top of the show.
Let's get to a caller. We've got Robert on the line in Green Bay. Robert, hi.
Hey, how you doing? I am a former auxiliary police officer with the Milwaukee Police Department. I am also a former state licensed guard, and I work hand-in-hand with the police department on many occasions. I have seen some terribly corrupt things that have happened within the police department, even going as far as the police department when they would arrest somebody for drug possession or do a raid, how they would turn in only some of the evidence, and some of the evidence went to drug houses that they know of, and they would even protect these drug houses and profit from them. They know of known gang activity. The city is just incredibly corrupt all the way around.
Gotcha, Robert. Not much time left, but Erica, is there an effort to change either the reality or the perception of that kind of corruption in the police force?
There certainly is an effort to change both. I think that, I certainly can't speak to the kind of crimes that our caller talked about, and I would certainly urge the individual, if he knows the specifics and names and places, that there are authorities who would be interested in hearing about that and would want to investigate. But I will say that one example may be the recent, and it was not, in a sense, in some ways, a good day for the police department, but in other ways it was. The recent filing of charges against several police officers who were accused of engaging in body cavity searches without proper warrants, without proper authority of suspected drug criminals. And those have led to, there was certainly some outrage about that as that news came out, and they have also led to criminal charges. I think Chief Flynn has been pretty serious about trying to change the code of conduct, and not just the code of conduct, but the actual living up to the code of conduct. I also would note that that he's tried to draw a line between honest mistakes and true bad action. And I think that's sometimes led him not to pursue as harshly some situations that others might have wanted to see him. People are still. It took a long time to fire the officer involved in the Dontre Hamilton shooting.
Leave it there. Eric Gunn, thanks for joining us. That was Milwaukee-based journalist Eric Gunn. His recent piece, How Milwaukee Went Soft on Crime, appeared in Politico Magazine's most recent installment of What Works, a look at innovative ideas that are reinventing cities. Now a follow-up on the Thanksgiving food controversy known as Grapegate. As we heard yesterday, the New York Times tried to select a symbolic Thanksgiving food for every state. They angered our neighbors in Minnesota by picking grape salad to represent them.
You've had a lot to say about that topic on Facebook. To represent Wisconsin, Mary suggests Brussels sprouts with bacon, pine nuts, and fresh nutmeg sprinkled over.
Okay, I'm in. And Amy asks if brandy slush counts as a dish. I'm not sure. I might put that to the test, though, myself, find out what it is. Yeah,
you can make it up maybe as you go along. But we've also had some grape salad fans. Emily says, I can vouch for grape salad. My grandma made it for almost every holiday. Couldn't get enough of it.
And Sandy wins the internet with this one. She writes, the camp version of grape salad, and I use the term salad loosely, was green grapes, cream cheese, Cool Whip, and crushed Butterfinger candy bars mixed in. She says, my kids say they'll eat salad any day if it's like grape salad.
Yeah, that sounds okay.
Yeah,
Butterfingers,
yeah.
Cool Whip, really
salad
so much.
That's dessert territory at that point, yeah.
Exactly. Well, you can share your thoughts on this and other topics in the news over at the Central Time Facebook page.